Hey, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. Thank you very, very much for taking the time to join us today. I do appreciate you. And as always, feel free to reach out, Jeff, at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. Well, today is episode 176. This is a continuation and a part two of our discussion with Peg DeSanto. So if you have not listened to episode 175, please go back and listen to that first. Otherwise, you're going to be kind of coming in the middle of things. So I'm not going to waste any more of anybody's time with chit-chat, jibber-jabber, all that kind of good stuff. We're going to jump right back in and resume where we left off with Peg.
The other thing that I want to talk about, just to revisit cold bees, is we talked about the temperature in which bees cluster, which is about 50 to 55 degrees. But what a lot of people don't think about is here's these bees clustering, say it's 50, 40 degrees. But Etienne's research says at 14 degrees, this cluster can't get any tighter. Like there's a limit to how tight this cluster can get to try to, you know, maintain some heat or generate heat. And at 14 degrees, if that cold threat persists, then this outer layer of bees on the outside of the cluster will go into a chill coma and start dropping off the cluster until you have just a pile of dead bees at the bottom of your colony. And so, well, there's a point where they can't do anything more to protect themselves. The other thing that I hear from a lot of beekeepers is when that cluster is so tight, it can't even move. And there's a lot of reports that beekeepers say, well, they opened their dead colony in the spring and they found this cluster of frozen bees inches or even an inch away from honey. And they mistakenly think that their bees starved to death, but they really didn't, right? There's plenty of honey in the hive. They froze to death because the cluster was too cold to move. And if the colony would have been well insulated, they would have been able to move freely to access the honey. And so that's another common mistake beekeepers make, that they starve to death when it really was a cold issue. It wasn't that they didn't have enough food. However, starving to death can also happen, and it's, again, because the bees are cold and they're shivering and vibrating their wing muscles in high metabolic state, and they end up consuming all the honey you left them because they just needed it for warmth. And then they starve to death because they open their hives and there's no honey left. And the other problem with that high honey consumption state in the winter, at least in Minnesota, where we don't have a lot of opportunities for cleansing flights, when you sort of force your bees to consume so much honey and water to dilute the honey, that risks dysentery, right, and spreading Nosema. And so there's just a bunch of negative effects of having too cold of bees. So, you know, people don't really realize just how tough it is on them. And it is. It's a very, very stressful and very preventable killer of your colony. If not stressor, definitely a killer. And then I'm going to jump around a little bit. I don't know how much time we have, but another piece of research that I really want to share because it really matters. This, again, is Etienne's research, but there was also a research study done in Egypt that very much validated the same findings. And I find a lot of beekeepers don't know this, that the amount of like space, like hive box space you overwinter in should match the actual size of your colony. That too many hive boxes to too few bees is a recipe for disaster. The study in Egypt showed that colony strength, leftover honey, leftover pollen, earlier brooding, all happened in the smallest hive box configuration. And so really, about this time of year, you know, maybe later in the day when the bees aren't foraging, take a peek at your hive and kind of get an idea on hive strength. Remember, some of them are probably still summer bees, some are drones, so whatever colony size you have now will be less as far as overwintering in. And as far as like, well, how many hive boxes, the research says if you have at least 6 full frames of bees, that's how many you need per deep hive box. You know, preferably even more than 6. But so if you have a smallish colony, say you only have a colony that really only fills, say, 8 frames of a single deep, overwinter them in a single deep. Again, Etienne in the Yukon, his best survival is in single deeps. And Seeley's research says that the natural tree cavities, when they measured how much actual space is in them, the average size of natural tree cavities was equal to a single deep. So another piece of advice is less space is more. I mean, think about, do you want to heat a three-story mansion or would you rather heat a tiny one-story bungalow? And so another way to reduce the stress of your bees in the winter is pare down the hive box sizes. An old way of overwintering was three deeps, but I believe it's because a lot of times in that model, they really weren't insulating. A lot of times they would ventilate or do tar paper. And in that case, the bees might have needed three deeps of honey because they're consuming that much honey. But in a well-insulated hive, you just don't need that much honey. So you don't need that much hive space. So that would be another little tidbit of advice I would give beekeepers is match your hive boxes. And that's why, like, we have a really brilliant beekeeper here in Minnesota. His name's escaping me, but he wrote an overwintering in nukes. And similar, yeah, we've had beekeepers have wildly successful overwintering rates in nukes, again, because it's a small colony. And so don't be afraid of shrinking them down into smaller hive box spaces.
Yeah, great info. You know, it's funny, the first time that I heard that, like that 40 liter, you know, kind of space, which is roughly about the size of a deep, when I first heard that, I thought, well, there's no way that can be right. But obviously, you're reading something that is by people who studied it and did quite a bit of research and found it to be true. But that was a really fascinating thing when that was kind of brought to my attention, and to realize that, you know, that they need far less, which then shifts the discussion back to making sure that the information that is being shared, like you're sharing right now, like, hey, we got these folks out there who, you know, overwintered in nukes. And, you know, it goes back to my thing with Eddie in a long time ago, like, you can't do that. But with the right configuration and the right setup, you know, you definitely can make that happen. But yeah, and to answer your question, we have plenty of time, so don't feel like you have rush. Yeah, you don't have to rush anything. We can go until we fall over.
Okay. All right. Well, that sounds good. Again, I'm by far not an expert, but a lot of people kind of have questions about CO2. And again, I've read the research. I haven't done the research, but I can share that Etienne just presented at a conference and has some new CO2 data. I know Jeff in one of your talks the last couple times, you also talked about it. And I'm going to just share that CO2 is also a byproduct of metabolism. Like humans, bees also have exhale CO2. And like humans, there's a certain level that becomes dangerous. I mean, for us, like, you know, 500 parts per million is sort of okay, up to 30,000 and we need to evacuate immediately or we could die. Bees, they have a much higher tolerance for CO2 levels. Etienne's research says that around 10,000 parts per million, the bees will kind of go into a little bit of a hypoxia-driven low metabolic rate. And so it also helps slow down their metabolism. But these CO2-induced sort of super states are more at sort of subarctic temps, that if, you know, even with really good insulation, there is a point where they do get cold enough that they need to go to kind of the next level of survival, which starts to look at, you know, CO2 hypoxia driven low metabolic rate. And when you use top vents, which is a common practice, again, because people are trying to vent out the moisture, it lowers CO2 levels and it disrupts the bees' ability to use CO2 to help regulate their metabolism to help improve survival. So just another reason not to venture colonies. And there is some data that says that about 40 to 60,000 parts per million CO2 kills about 70% of the varroa mites. And so, you know, these are high levels, but there is also some benefit, according to Etienne's research, on varroa suppression with elevated CO2 levels. So that's my sort of revisiting or summarizing some of Etienne's research that he shared at the last conference. So, and since we're touching a little bit on varroa, there has also been some research studies that say high humidity, relative humidity levels also help suppress varroa reproduction. 82% humidity has also been beneficial. Varroa can't reproduce as well in high humid states. So again, when we're venting out our humidity by putting in upper entrances, we also lose that potential benefit. So just a couple other interesting tidbits on overwintering and the benefits of doing the condensing hive. So, you know, bees get this benefit naturally, and so we can too if we overwinter our bees like bees do in nature.
So I'm glad you shared that point as it relates to like the well, everything is great, but the varroa component specifically, because I had heard similar information not long ago about the increased CO2 levels resulting in the, you know, the varroa just not being able to survive at that, at the, some of those levels. And I was curious if you had heard anything new. So I appreciate you sharing that with us. And I, you know, it's so funny because I've been thinking about this. It's been on my mind for a long time. You know, how do we still have, you know, for lack of a better word, whether it's feral or unmanaged or whatever the terminology you'd like to use, how do we still have colonies in the wild that are finding a way to survive, and they're not using Apivar, oxalic acid, formic pro, they're not using anything, and yet they still manage to figure it out. So I, it kind of comes back again to me saying like, hey, don't become part of the problem. Like if you don't want to keep bees, then just don't keep bees, but don't stick them in your box and leave them alone. So.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, no, Tom Seeley is brilliant. You know, he really is a proponent of, and taking the Cornell Master Beekeeping course right now. So I'm getting to learn more about his research and I just love his approach. The Darwinian beekeeping is what are bees doing? And we can't say that enough times. I mean, they're brilliant. I mean, again, they've evolved over millions of years. They've survived. And so, yeah, I mean, I think we all realize they're extremely intelligent and have the capacity to take care of themselves. So paying attention to what they do is very wise.
Well, you know, the article and research that you had mentioned, and what I'm going to do is I've got an area, because I'm pretty sure this is publicly available. I don't think it's any kind of restricted or limited release. You might know off the top of your head. Do you know about that? It's the Thinking Outside the Box, Temperature Dynamics in a Tree Cavity.
That's the research that I have been referring to. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think you sent me this one. That's where I got it from. And what I'm going to do is I've got a resources area on the website. So for those of you playing along at home, I'm going to post this to the Beekeeping for Newbies homepage under the resources where we have other PDFs and things so that you can read this. And what Peg is talking about here is Radcliffe and Seeley. And this is the study that was done in August of 2022. And it says here, Thinking Outside the Box, Temperature Dynamics in a Tree Cavity, Wooden Box, and Langstroth Hives with or without insulation. And kind of a fun thing at the beginning, I don't know who this is in the image. I don't know if it's Tom himself, but the first picture that you see is somebody taking a chainsaw and cutting a cavity out of a tree, probably to do some experimenting and monitoring with. So that's kind of a interesting article, and I'll be sure to get that posted within the next couple of days so that you guys get, who are listening can check that out.
Yeah, it's a great resource. Yeah, thank you for sharing that with the listeners. I do have one more thing that I would like to share, and I don't have the research study in front of me, so I might not get the numbers exactly right, but this concept of winter bees, there was a research study done actually in Canada, but the climate zone was similar to Minnesota. It was done in a climate zone 3. And what they did is they literally marked the bees as they were born to kind of, and then they followed them through the season. And their goal was to figure out when are our winter bees born. And I don't know if some of the newer beekeepers don't know this, but there are like physiological differences between the bees that are born that are intended to be the winter bees. Like they have more fat bodies, their hormones are a little different, that sort of prepare them to overwinter, you know, all those months. Because, you know, summer forager bees might live 6 weeks, but these winter bees are in for the duration. And they wanted to know, like, well, when are they being born? And so I was surprised that 40% of the winter bees in climate zone 3 are born by August 16th. That's when they're born. And so let's backtrack that to when they're larvae. And you know that it's in the larvae stage that the varroa enter, because that's where they reproduce in the larvae stage. So even earlier than August 16th, is when these winter bees are susceptible to varroa. And where I'm going with this is a common mistake I see beekeepers do is they'll say, oh, well, by, you know, by October 1st, my mite counts were down to 2. But in, you know, September 1st, they were really, really high. And they like using oxalic or, you know, things that they can use when there's no brood or, you know, formic when it's cooler. But I'm learning that beekeepers don't realize that if your winter bees are born in mid-August and you haven't gotten your mite count, you know, controlled, and that's when the virus and the transmissions of, you know, the viruses happens, then your winter bees are already sick. And so who cares what your mite count is in November, because your winter bees are already infected. Because something that, you know, mites, the phoretic mites feeding on the bees isn't great, but it's the diseases that kill them. And so to consider getting your mites counts lower way earlier so that your winter bees are healthier and not waiting too late. And again, I don't really want to weigh in on treatment or treatment-free. I mean, if you want my opinion, I'm a big fan of the, you know, the hygienic bees, and the beekeepers are doing great work, you know, developing the strains that are more varroa resistant. I believe that's the way of the future. But until we're there, you know, managing mites makes sense. So anyway, that's another little piece of research that I wanted to share about when winter bees are actually born, at least in this climate. So
yeah, that's really neat, because I think you always associate it with the winter bees being born, you know, just within hours of it being too cold for them to fly for the season, you know, that kind of thing.
Totally, so that's, right?
That's a great tidbit there. And, you know, you talked about varroa, and you know, I'm like I'm trying to say this in the right way. I am very tough on people with varroa, because I was terrible. Like when I first started, I had some kind of weird denial syndrome thing where I was like, well, I know that it happens to some people, but it's not going to happen to me. And I was really intermittent. I think like the first year, I don't think I did any treatment. And then my second year, I was like, oh, well, maybe I should do that. But it almost seemed to me like as casual as, oh, well, maybe I should move the entrance from 3 inches to 1 inch. Like just something that was not a big deal. Like it's not a, you probably ought to do it, but whatever. And I didn't for a while. And I was having failures. I didn't really understand why. And there's multiple, obviously there's a lot of moving parts with it, but you nailed a really, really big one where someone will tell me like, well, I did my treatment, you know, my end of winter treatment. I went ahead and put the varroa strips on in March, or varroa strips, the Apovar strips on in March before I, you know, put my honey supers on, you know, I'll just treat them again in like August or September. And my mite numbers look great in September, so I'm good. And it's like, no. Yeah. You got rid of all the mites. But like you said, those viral loads are through the roof, and you're wondering why you're not overwintering, you know, so then yeah. You have a scenario where they were not able to overwinter. You had, you know, 15 frames of honey still sitting there. And then it goes to, well, is it moisture related, condensation related? What was the problem? Well, the problem is the viral loads. And I spend a lot of time and energy trying to emphasize the importance of that. I think that the VSH, you know, queens and that kind of a approach, you know, it makes a lot of sense. I think that one of the challenges with that then becomes the folks who will say, well, no, I don't need to worry about that. I've got a VSH queen, so we're good. And it's like, well, you still kind of need to monitor. You got to keep an eye on things. And then the follow on to that is, I think we're probably still a couple of years away, but how long before we start dealing with tropolalaps or some of these other things that are always on the horizon? So, you know, what's going to be the next big killer of bees?
Yeah, right. Yeah, we have enough stressors out there that we can't control. I mean, so why don't we control the ones that we can? Yeah, the bees need our help. Yeah, like you said earlier, you know, we've taken on being their keepers, and so we have responsibility in helping them stay well. And yeah, strong immune system's a biggie. So
that first cup of coffee really sets the tone for the whole day. If you haven't tried an AeroPress yet, you're in for something special. AeroPress uses a unique brewing method that delivers a smooth, rich, and balanced cup of coffee with less bitterness. So you actually taste the roast, the origin, and the full character of the beans. Smooth, balanced, and full-bodied. It's like the best part of a French press, a pour over, and even espresso combined into one compact brewer. And it's built for real life. Durable, portable, and consistently great whether you're at home, at work, on the road, camping, or traveling anywhere life takes you. Plus, it's the fastest single cup maker out there. About 2 minutes start to finish, including cleanup, so you're never waiting long for great coffee. AeroPress is shockingly affordable, less than $50, and we've got an incredible offer. Visit AeroPress.com/honey. That's AeroPress.com/honey and use promo code honey to save 20% off your order. That's AeroPress.com/honey, promo code honey at checkout. So ditch the drive-thru, skip the bulky gear, and start your mornings with a better cup of coffee wherever you are. Big thanks to AeroPress for sponsoring this show. You know what still really messes me up? I still have a hard time with this is... And I've been doing this now, I guess, about 14 years. And I still, in my mind, I feel like beekeeping should be really easy. I feel like here's the bees, here's the box. Put the bees in the box and then just get a little bit of honey and have a great day. I don't think anybody knows. And I put together a video that's over on YouTube where it's basically, you know, how much does it really cost to keep bees? And I put together, you know, what I always recommend that people start with two colonies. That way they can kind of do a comparison as they're developing and have just some basis of comparison. And it's a lot of money. And I don't think people really understand that part of it. But then there's on top of it, it's, hey, in addition to basically learning a new career, it's not like you decided like, oh, I think I'm going to learn how to skateboard or something. And then like you skateboard a little bit and you step off and go, yeah, I'll do it again, you know, in a month or two. Like once you make the commitment, you're already probably over $1,000 in. And then you got to keep going. That's the beginning. And I've told people, I've said, look, take whatever you think you're going to spend and just multiply it by two or three by the time you start supplemental feeding and start doing all your treatments. And then, oh, well, everybody tells you you ought to split. That sounds like fun. And then you can multiply your expenditures. So it's, I really wish that it was as simple as I think that it should be, but it is definitely a part-time job. It's not really a hobby. It's not a set it and forget it kind of thing.
Yeah. And then they don't warn you that you're going to fall in love with your bees. And then the money doesn't matter, right? It's like a child or a pet that you just like, yeah, no, whatever it takes. No, I'm going to buy it for them. Because you love these little things. I mean, who knew you'd fall in love with these insects? But it's universal. I mean, I talk to a lot of beekeepers and they get into your heart. and it becomes a bit obsessive even. So there's that.
Oh, yeah, I've had the messages where it's like, well, we had to say goodbye to Janine today. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't know who Janine. Oh, Janine is the queen in hive number three. She, she's been with us for 3 years now. And I'm like, right? Oh, okay, all right. Well, aww. You know, and it's funny because if you ever hear like Michael Palmer, you know, and he talks about the way he always talks about his queens and things like that. But it's hard. I mean, it's hard not to be attached to him, especially when, you know, especially when it becomes a family thing. Like I've got a guy named Dill and his daughter Bella out there in the UK. I hear from them periodically. There's, I think the young man's name is Chase, I believe, down in Texas, who keeps bees with his granddad. You know, you got all these people all over where it becomes a family thing. And it's a real way to connect with one another, but also, you know, showing younger people or people you care about the connection to nature and how important that it is that we are involved in some capacity, if nothing else, to appreciate the complexity. Like I think that, well, here's an example. I was talking with someone not long ago and I said, well, you mentioned that you were going to feed this fall and winter or going into the winter, you know, what's your strategy and what are you thinking about? And they were telling me about some of the supplements they were going to use. And I said, well, I need you to keep in mind, nature provides the right types of feed and pollen and resources at that time of year. So while the bees might need a little bit of pollen here and there, of course, to raise some of that winter brood, they really are building up fat bodies. They need a lot of carbs, and the amino acid breakdown the resources that are available are going to have a different composition of the various amino acids in the spring than they would in the fall. So make sure that you're trying to be as close as you can to what nature actually provides at that time of year versus just taking whatever you have laying around and throwing it to the bees and hoping that it mm-hmm. works out.
Mm-hmm. So. And in fact, the research says it is not good to leave pollen patties in over winter. You know, that protein source could trigger the queen to start raising brood. And beekeepers sort of don't think about that. They're like, well, it's just food, you know, what's wrong with having pollen over the winter? But yeah, for sure, not a great idea. And generally, you know, this is just a guideline, is feed it to the colony in the spring after their first cleansing flights. So there's no big rush either to kind of get them fed a pollen supplement too early in the spring either. So,
yeah. Well, and like we discussed earlier, when you were talking about, you know, the bees coming out of winter, you know, end of the winter, going right before the spring, and just how critical of a time that is. I am a big evangelist for that, and discussing that and making sure people understand that, because I've lost colonies and it's so sad, but I've had some where you get like a beautiful week in February and everything just looks like, oh man, here we go. It's early spring. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, you're losing a colony. I pulled one out a couple of years ago. I had 5 frames of brood and they were all capped. It was ready to go and they were frozen and dead because they took the last of those pollen resources to raise that brood, the last of everything they had. And then it just got too cold. And so it's a little heartbreaking, but you know, like you mentioned, it is a time when losses are high, and it's not unusual to see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Peg, I think that might be a good opportunity here to transition over. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about some ideas that you had and how you kind of pursued an idea to maybe go after this challenge that we have as beekeepers here and some of these overwintering challenges.
Yeah. Well, it's a little bit of a love story, but it's a true story. So back, you know, when I was losing my colonies year after year, and I literally tried every winterization system under the sun, even like straw bales, DIYs, and really didn't see any improvement. And around this time, I started dating a man, his name's Henry, but he owns a business in high-tech insulation. And I thought, oh boy, this one's a keeper. I'm just kidding, but there was some of that. I'm like, wow, that's a definite bonus. And I was desperate, and I literally said, would you please, you know, he has access to engineers and thermodynamics and, you know, the most high-tech insulation on the planet, and I just said, would you build me an insulation system for my bees? And bless him, he tried. I mean, he sort of tried to, but he's not a beekeeper, so he really didn't know the thermodynamics. But with access to that technology, I thought, okay, I'm gonna do it. And with his, you know, his backing, because he's got more of a business background. As I said, I'm a nurse, and so together we set out to create an insulation system, best on the planet. And so we came up with this design. I mean, it's called the Hive Hugger, but what's key is it's data driven. It's based in science, and all the science that we talked about, it's based on a condensing hive. So no upper ventilations. The top of the hive is insulated with an insulation panel that's an R30, and the sidewalls are about an R9, which is what the research recommends. But what's really key that puts our system on the map far above anything else on the market, and I don't want to sound like I'm bragging, but the high-tech insulation is called a vacuum insulation panel. Yeti uses them in their coolers. So high-tech, but like thermoses, remember the day of thermoses?
Sure, yeah.
Thermoses are vacuum sealed, and in a vacuum, there are no air molecules. And without air molecules, heat transfer or heat loss is greatly slowed down. And so some brilliant person thought, well, why don't I make an actual panel, an insulation panel, that's a vacuum? And so they did. And if you Google vacuum insulation panels, you'll see they're like an R46. Typical expanded polystyrene foam board, like you get at Home Depot, is about an R4 or 5. And so it's 10 times more efficient than foam board. It's the most efficient insulation on the planet. And so because of Henry's connections, we've incorporated this vacuum insulation panel into the hive kit. And it goes on top of the hive, and it's a game changer because you're getting like 8 inches of insulation and literally less than an inch of this vacuum panel. And then the side walls are R8. And if you add the wood box, that's about an R1. So you get an almost a 9 on the side walls. The foam board wrap is expanded polystyrene, high density. And we have them professionally laser jet cut from a company in Wisconsin. So they sort of fit together like puzzle pieces. The corners are sort of cut out that way. And so that provides the science recommended R value on the sidewalls and the R30 on the top. And so the product's been on the market. This will be our third year of sales. And we've sold in 49 states. Because beekeepers in the southern climates are reporting that it actually helps keep their hives cooler in the hot weather as well. And there's a couple of research studies that back it up as well. But it's a game changer. 75% of our sales are repeat customers. They try out a couple and the results are mind-boggling. It really, really works. Again, it's coming from me, so I'm obviously biased, but it's by far the best system on the market. And you know, I don't want to spend a ton of time on it because I didn't get into this business to sell product or to make money. I delved into developing winterization system to literally to save my bees. But when I realized like, oh, geez, like we're onto something. I remember the day Henry and I were sitting on his front porch and I'm like, do we blow this up? Like, do we try to make a product? Because I, you know, I'm 60 and he's 64. Like, we're kind of retirement age and we're doing a startup at this age. Like, are we nuts? But I couldn't say no. It was just like, we have to say yes. How can you not develop this product and make it available to beekeepers? And in the same breath, you do not need the hive hugger to create a condensing hive, you know, just literally get 6 or 8 inches of foam board, take a medium or a deep hive box. That's what Etienne does in the Yukon and stuff it full of foam board and then go to Home Depot and get a, you know, enough foam board wrap to do an R10. In fact, I gave a bee talk to a club, I don't know, an hour from here. This is last year. And this beekeeper has 105 colonies and he was taking notes and he was paying attention, didn't buy a single thing, which is fine. But this spring he reported to the bee club that he said, remember that Peggy lady who spoke to us? He said, I did what she said to do and did a DIY on 105 colonies. And he had 3 colonies not make it. And he said, you know, earlier brooding, less honey consumption, just super strong colonies coming through in spring. And I couldn't be happier. In fact, I have a bunch of beekeepers email me that they did a DIY. And thank you for the information. So my goal in life is to help create a paradigm shift, to help educate beekeepers on what the science says. If you want to buy the product, great. But yeah, that's not my mission. It's convenient, it's easy, but yeah, I'm really here to help you just know kind of what's recommended and empower beekeepers with information so they can, you know, take better care of their bees. So yeah, if you want to learn about the product, it's hivehugger.com. And if you do want to purchase it, I will give you a discount for supporting Jeff's podcast and helping save bees. And so if you do choose to purchase the product, there will be 11% discount if you enter capital B, capital K, the number 4, and capital N. So beekeepers for newbies. So yeah, and again, I want to be sensitive to not have this podcast be about a sales pitch because I actually would have been okay if we didn't talk about the product at all. I want you to take away more of the content and the information and the science.
Well, the good news is I think most of the listeners know, I think you are the only interview we've done this year. There's a lot. It's been a busy year. There's been a lot going on. I almost think that Randy might have been the last one we had last year. It's been a while, but I wouldn't bring somebody on who was all here's my widget. You got to buy it kind of thing. So they already know that. But you know what you touched on, I think it's really important is you know, life is always that time money kind of balance. We know when I was young, I had no money, plenty of time, good health. You just go do whatever you want to do. You just didn't have any money to do it. And then, you know, you get a little bit older and, you know, you have a little bit more money, but you don't have, well, depending on your situation, you may or may not have more money. But if you have the time, go ahead and create fun projects and do some of these things yourself. But sometimes, especially for those who are, you know, getting into the hobby and making big investments, how much of these things do you want to keep doing on your own? And can you just outsource it to somebody who's already kind of figured it out? Like, when you mentioned about it, I have already seen the website and I've seen some of the things and I thought, well, that looks really thin. I'm like, well, I'm going to come back and reread this later on to kind of see if I can get some more information and get a better understanding. But with that vacuum technology being what it is, you don't have to have, you know, 30 or 40 inches of foam on top of the hive. So that's a completely kind of game-changing aspect of it as well. And we definitely appreciate you offering that discount. And folks, what I'll do is I'll make sure to put a link in the podcast notes as well as in the Discord room if you're there. If you're not in either of those, you can always just email me, jeff@beekeepingfornewbies.com, and I can just make sure you have that information. But yeah, it's a really cool technology. I do have a follow-up for you. So you mentioned that you have the company out in Wisconsin and they're doing, you know, a lot of your manufacturing and everything. So if I have, let's say, I use a lot of different things within the apiary. I'll be anything from 8-frame to 10-frame. I do 2, 4, and 5-frame nukes, you know, lots of different kinds of configuration options. What would you say that you have as like your standard kind of loadout or, you know, configuration? And then aside of that, you know, when I come to you and I say, well, hey, I like to overwinter, you know, double deep 4-frame nukes. You know, how would you handle something that's a little bit unusual or a little different?
Yeah, those are good questions. So I would say 90% of the sales are a double deep, 10-frame double deep. In 10-frame, we also have a deep plus a medium wrap option. We have option for a triple medium. A lot of women or maybe more elderly beekeepers use all mediums. So we have a triple medium. We have a single deep. And now we actually have added just a single medium as sort of an add-on wrap. An 8-frame, we currently only have a double deep. And as far as nukes go, when we were looking at creating a wrap for the nukes, we realized that between Dedant and Man Lake, that there is no standard nuke box size like there are as far as 8-frame and 10-frame standard sizes. But we've made several custom wraps for beekeepers who overwinter in nukes. The warehouse manager used to be a carpenter, and so he's really good at, you know, cutting our foam boards to make custom wraps. So that's an option. We do have a nuke crown, however, and we sort of just took the average between all the different nuke box sizes and made a crown panel that's sort of somewhere in the middle between what they've got on the market. So yeah, we have a lot of different size variations. And if you're looking for something that we don't have, we're pretty open to making custom orders as well.
Well, that's great to have that kind of flexibility, because I know a lot of times, you know, manufacturing can be, you know, really challenging. You have your, you know, your templates for things the way that they need to be done, and deviation sometimes can be a real challenge. So it's nice to have that flexibility for the varying configurations that are out there. Well, Peg, I mean, we've got a lot of information that you share today, and there's so many different dynamics at play when it comes to overwintering between, you know, condensation and moisture and the thermal dynamics of everything and CO2 and all of this. If you had to consolidate it down into a single, you know, elevator pitch, 30-second, you know, 3 to 4 sentence kind of thing, what would you say are kind of like the key factors? If somebody just says, look, I'm not going to listen to anything on this podcast today, I'm just going to listen to the last 30 seconds or a minute, what would you say would be the kind of like the lightning round key points that you want beekeepers to keep in mind as they are getting ready to go down the beekeeping journey, or they're getting ready to go into their first or even their 10th winter with, you know, what should they have in mind?
Well, I'm going to be a little provocative, because Derek Mitchell, one of the researchers, he wrote an article that he said, if you aren't insulating your hives, he sort of likened to being like abusive or neglectful to your bees. It was a little bit like not cool. And I don't know that I'll go that far, But I will say that if you live in a colder climate and you aren't providing any thermal support at all, your bees are absolutely taking a hit. If they were to live in a natural tree cavity, they would be provided a lot more thermal support than pretty much, you know, beekeepers are accustomed to providing for them. And the data is really, really clear that it's more than you would imagine, that we need to provide like an R30 on top and an R10 on the sidewalls in order to give our bees the protection and the health and the support that they need to make it over the winter.
Well, Peg, I think everything you said, very well said today. I mean, lots of great information, and we thank you very much for that. And I'm going to definitely try to incorporate some Hive Hugger into some of my research studies as well this coming winter, and we'll get some in live hives next year. But thank you very, very much for joining us today. And if you ever are hanging out, you have some big updates you'd like to share with us, or you just want to come back and share more information, or you know, you've been conducting, involved in, or just want to share some research, you're always welcome to come back and chat with the crew if you'd like.
Oh, very kind. Thank you for that warm welcome. I enjoyed it. It was a great conversation. And thank you for creating this venue for people to get, you know, good information and data-driven information. I know it's a lot of work, so I really appreciate you.
Well, thank you. We couldn't do it without contributions from folks like yourself. And remember, everybody, so, you know, beekeepingfornewbies.com, that's N-E-W-B-E-E-S. And we're going to get that 11% discount set up at Hive Hugger using code capital B, capital K, number 4, capital N, and we'll get you set up with there. All right, Peg, well, thank you so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Be well. Take care.
All right, everybody. Well, I hope you enjoyed the discussion with Peg and hearing all about Hive Hugger and all the cool things that she's doing over there. I thought it was a really great story, and I really love her passion and just how committed she is to the overall, you know, a broader well-being of the beekeeping community. And just, you know, you can always tell when somebody just wants to sell you something, and in her mindset is just so far outside of that. She's just really excited about what she's doing and what she's discovered. And it's really admirable to see that kind of passion and excitement and everything. So I hope you guys enjoyed our discussion. Reach out to us over there in the Discord room. The link is off of the Beekeeping for Newbies homepage. It's newbees.com. And again, special thanks to all of our Buy Me a Coffee folks. Can't do it without you. Check us out over at bestbeekeepinggear.com as well for some info on Varroa, a few other things. Oh, and I forgot to mention, wanted to make sure you know that we did update the resources section of the Beekeeping for Newbies homepage to include two recent articles. One of them is the one that Peg and I were discussing, and there's also another one that I added on there as well that I thought was pretty relevant that you folks might enjoy. But outside of that, take care, be kind to one another. Remember that I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it. We'll talk to you soon.